Welcome to Mighty Parenting, the podcast with real, raw, and relevant talk about raising teens and parenting young adults. Here are your hosts, Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler.
Welcome to Mighty Parenting, a community where we help you raise teens and parent 20-somethings so they can become happy, successful, and emotionally healthy adults. I'm Sandy Fowler. I'm here with my co-host, Judy Davis, doing what we love best, the Mighty Parenting Podcast, or at least one of the things we love best. And we know that you love more than just a podcast, and sometimes you need support in other forms, and we appreciate all the support you give us. So we invite you to go to mightyparenting.com and explore the site, see what's there for you, and check out mightyparenting.com/support to find out how you can get more from us and how you can help support us. We appreciate the things that you guys do, sharing and liking the show, commenting, leaving iTunes reviews, sharing questions with us. All those things are great. We also love being able to give you the private content for those who financially support us as a way of connecting with you more and building more community with you. Today, we are talking about dating violence, and we were talking with our guest before the show, and it kind of struck me, it's, you know, a little bit funny when I hear Judy and I say it. We were so excited to cover this topic, not because it's fun and not because it's exciting, but because it's essential. This is something that we need to really understand as parents, because there are so many ways that kids can be affected in a relationship, and we got to help prepare them, and we may have to help guide them, and we may have to help pick up pieces. I know when I was in high school, I was not prepared for emotional manipulation that I experienced in a dating relationship. But having experienced that, at least it opened my eyes and it helped me out and gave me a little bit of something to go with when my daughter ran into a sticky dating situation. And what was interesting to me, though, is that I discovered that today's culture really magnifies the effects of unhealthy behaviors in dating relationships.
Yeah, I mean, things are so different than when we were in those dating years. And part of me is like, shoot, so glad I don't have to do it now. Because it is, you know, there's this trend that happens. And it's not just that instant exclusivity that I see happening, but our kids and their relationships, not only with their friends, but with their boyfriends and girlfriends, it's 24/7 and they never seem to get a break from one another. I mean, I even know that my nieces and nephews that are in college right now, they use dating apps to meet people. So they're missing that connection of liked activities, you know, kind of mutual friends introducing one another and knowing people before they enter into a relationship. And I think that what happens because of that is that everything is much more intense and escalated, and it opens us up to be interacting with situations that we're not able to kind of see ahead of time of problems that could happen. And that is why we are thrilled to actually have an expert in this topic. Dr. Shalonda Moten is with us today, and she is here to help us understand all the ways that dating violence can happen and what we can do as parents to help our kids navigate the dating world safely. She is the founder of the Prevention Collective and one of the leading experts in dating violence prevention. And over the past decade, she has dug in and educated over 3,500 youth about healthy and unhealthy relationships. Her work is so incredible. It's even been featured on NBC's Parent Toolkit, Huffington Post, MTV Act, and Fox 5. So welcome, Dr. Moten, to the show today.
Oh, thank you guys so much for having me.
You know, Dr. Moten, I think we've run into a couple issues with dating violence. One being that we have preconceived notions about it, and two, being that it's misunderstood. Like, we don't understand all the different types of abuse that can occur, and so we don't recognize them when they start. So would you kick us off here by helping us, like, name the different types of abuse that can happen, and then we can explore those a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. So yes, there are definitely multiple types of dating violence. The most common ones that I have encountered are emotional abuse, and there's also digital abuse, and there is physical abuse, and then there is sexual abuse. And if you like, I can go through each one of those just to give you a couple of examples of what those look like.
Yeah, let's start talking about emotional abuse first.
Okay. Well, emotional abuse oftentimes is also called verbal abuse. And that can include a partner yelling or screaming at their significant other. They might say mean and hurtful things to their partner. They might even make threats towards their partner. And sometimes those threats are also directed towards themselves. So they'll say things like, if you leave me, I'll hurt myself. Or they'll say, if you leave me, I'll hurt others. So it can include actual verbal statements, but it can also include gestures. So the person can make lots of like facial expressions to indicate that they're upset with their partner. They can smash things against a wall to let their partner know that they're dissatisfied with something that they're doing. And so the teams that I work with oftentimes describe emotional abuse as like mind games, where their partner like makes up these different rules with them. Then they'll change those rules without actually letting them know that the rules have actually changed. And then they'll punish them for not adhering to those rules. But I think the most common type of emotional abuse that people think of is isolation. So keeping a partner away from their friends and their families. That seems to be the most common form that I've noticed.
And does that happen over time, Shalonda, or is it something like when they would start dating someone, all of a sudden they just kind of separate them from friends and family and things like that? Or is that a gradual thing that happens when you're talking about isolation?
Yes, most definitely it happens over time, because usually in a dating relationship, the beginning stages, I mean, there's definitely a deep level of infatuation with the other person. They're spending every moment together. They're connecting, like you were mentioning, in person, online, on their phones. And so things are moving pretty quickly in the relationship. And then usually there's a point where you kind of have to start to separate and go back to your individual worlds. And usually that's when conflict starts to emerge. And you'll have, the person in the relationship that's perpetrating the abuse, they'll usually start to say, no, I wanna spend more time with you. You're starting to pull away from me. I think you should let go of those things that you were interested in doing and spend more time with me. And so it's definitely, it happens pretty quickly at the beginning of the relationship, but at the same time, it is spread out over time as far as the individual asking their partner to spend more time with them and then to cut things off in their life. That happens over time.
So that would be a red flag, not at the beginning of a relationship that people spend a lot of time together. But like you said, you do hit that point where it's natural to go, okay, we can't be together every waking moment. If you want to spend time with, you know, if a guy wants to hang out with his buddies, girl wants to hang out with her girlfriends, or go spend time with family, if you are suggesting spending time away from this new romantic relationship and you're getting very negative feedback about that.
Yes.
That's a warning sign then, a red flag to say, hey, keep an eye on this.
Yes, that's absolutely a red flag.
So that was the kind of emotional abuse in a nutshell. What about digital?
So digital abuse is almost like an extension of emotional abuse, except that it's transitioning to online or a mobile device. So usually this term is like people use the words digital or technology abuse when they're trying to find out more information about this. And there are really like subtypes of this type of abuse. So the first one, as far as a subtype, is textual harassment. And this is where a partner is constantly texting their significant other at all hours of the day, asking them who they're with, what they're doing, even what they're wearing. And it's so interesting because the research shows that a lot of this conversation is happening between midnight and 4 a.m. So when your teen is supposed to be sleeping, you know, their partner is reaching out to them, asking them these types of questions. And it also can be just during school hours, just kind of if they don't have the same schedule and they're not really sure where their partner is, they're constantly trying to check in with them to see where they're headed or what they're doing. So that's a very, very common one. But one thing that I like to point out is that it's not so much about the number of texts that their partner sends. It's more so how your teen is reacting to those text messages, meaning do they feel pressure to have to respond to their partner as opposed to their partner sent them 50 text messages. It's more about how is your teen responding when they get those text messages.
Well, what would be an indication of it being a problem?
It would be a problem if you were to set some boundaries with your teen and you said, okay, so I'm noticing that your partner is, you know, sending you a lot of text messages, and would like you to put your phone down, right? Like, I would like us to have dinner and there's not going to be any phone time, and your teen is like, no, I need to respond to that person. Like, and you can see that they are not able to really even focus, be present in the moment with you because they're fixated on trying to get to that message. That should be concerning to a parent, that their child feels like they have to respond to their partner.
I'm having a little bit of trouble with that one just because as parents of teens and 20-somethings, many times we feel that way about our kids' phones in general, that you know they're just way too attached. So I'm trying to kind of separate that out so I don't freak myself out that it's actually my child having a culturally normal response to having to reply to a text message versus an unhealthy relationship response. Just, you know, like I said, it's our generation, we didn't have that. We don't have such an intensity of needing to answer messages on our phone. So I don't know if there's something else that you have for us, if maybe there's another question to ask, or if it's more that, if it's the difference between just needing to pick up the phone versus that maybe there's almost like a little tension or fear in them that the not responding isn't about them and their phone, but about this other person reacting badly. Is that more of what we're looking for?
Yes, most definitely. As far as looking at the nonverbals of your child is definitely very important to be able to detect whether or not there is a sense of fear or urgency to be able to have to respond to that particular message. Because I totally understand what you mean, because they are glued to their phones and everything is so important and they have to be on the pulse of everything. But in dating violence situations, a lot of times it is the messages that the partner is sending tends to be very aggressive messaging, right? So as a parent, you know, my philosophy is that like their phone isn't necessarily their phone, right? I'm paying for it. I'm the one that is granting them access to that particular phone. So, you know, my team knows that like, you know, if you're going to have a phone at any point, I can check that phone, right? So if my child was receiving a text message and they were, you know, constantly beeping, and I was to check in with them and ask them, like, I'm noticing that you're getting a lot of text messages, and they were like, well, I need to answer this. Okay, let's talk more about that. Like, I think the conversation has to keep going as far as, you know, what's the reasoning for you needing to respond to that message right now, right? And really digging deeper as to what is so concerning that they need to answer their message, that particular message. But then even further, if you as a parent are concerned, I believe that it's important to say, you know, like if I was to look at your phone, you know, and I was to look at the messages that your partner is sending, like, would it be something that would be like that you feel comfortable showing me? Would you feel comfortable showing me those messages? And usually if you have a really solid relationship, your team will be willing to show you that information. But if they're like, I don't want you to look at that, I don't think that you need to see that, usually that could be an indicator that they're hiding something or they're not wanting to share something with you.
And that's especially true for those, you know, high school, junior high school years. I think when they get into the college years, that gets a little dicey to do that, but it all goes back to being willing and open to have the conversation, to go beyond the, I need to get that. Well, why is it so important when we're having a family moment? Or why do you need your phone with you at night? I remember back in our social media monster show, I think it was like in one of the very early episodes.
Episode 3 or 6, somewhere right at the beginning.
Exactly. She said that to be able to tame the social media monster, our kids shouldn't have their phones in their rooms after 10 p.m. And mm-hmm. It just seems like that's a great tactic to take, because as you're saying, most of this happens in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. And if we just remove that temptation, we're opening up that conversation, the ability to have the conversation about what is healthy and what is unhealthy.
To tell them, like, oh my gosh, this is just the first one. Okay, let's go.
Yeah. So there, the other ones is sexting or sextortion, right? So sexting is when a partner asks their significant other to send them private images or videos that contain sexually explicit content. So they'll say to their partner, especially if they use apps like Snapchat, they'll say, hey, look, don't worry. You know, send me this picture of you. It's going to disappear in 24 hours. Nobody's going to see this. However, their partner will usually, without their permission, screen capture that particular image or that video. And while Snapchat does actually notify the other user that someone has screen captured their image or video, by that point, their partner already has it. And then they begin to blackmail their partner. And they say, you know, like, if you don't send me more, or if you don't, if you break up with me, I'm going to spread this information all around the school, or I'm going to break up with you and if you don't do X, Y, and Z. So sexting is another type of digital abuse.
Okay, and is there a third or a fourth? Or?
Oh, yes. So there is also what is called digital stalking, and that is where you're basically keeping tabs on your partner. So you're keeping up with everything that they're doing online, right? You're following who they follow. You're following their friends. You're asking them to tag themselves in pictures with their friends so that their partner can be able to know where they are at all times. It also involves breaking into their partner's phones. So most of the time, teens, as a way of showing their commitment level, will share their passwords with their partner. And when they share their password, their partner can then get on their phone a lot of times without necessarily breaking into their account and just scroll through their direct messages, their instant messages, their text messages to kind of keep tabs on them. And the fourth type is cyberbullying by proxy. And so it's almost an extension of digital stalking. It's just that you enlist other people, like the abuser will enlist their friends to keep tabs on their partner. So they'll say, hey, you know, let me know what he's up to. Let me know what she's doing and where she's at right now. If you see her doing something that's inappropriate, say something mean and hurtful to her underneath her picture. And so it's where you almost are enlisting a third party to help you in almost abusing that person.
So I want to go back to what might be a minor point to other people, but it really grabbed my attention when you said that one of the ways that kids show their level of commitment is by sharing their phone password. Yes. I did not realize this was a common practice.
Oh, yes. Yes. There's two areas that they show their level of commitment. First is saying, I love you very, very quickly within the relationship, which is a huge warning sign. And then shortly after that, usually they will then share their passwords with each other, because they'll say, if there's, you have nothing to hide and you truly are committed to me, then at any point I should be able to look at your phone to see that you're not talking to anybody or doing anything inappropriate. And so they say, okay, I'll give you that information because I don't have anything to hide.
Now, is this isn't just in abusive relationships. This is across the board?
Yes, this is across the board. Yes,
so how can we help our kids to not do that? Well, and I guess the other question that just I realized as I asked that one is, and maybe I'm wrong, you, Judy and Shalonda, to me, that is something that our kids should not be sharing with somebody else, you know, just giving out that information. And maybe I'm a little too focused on that, but that one just, because our world is on our phones. I mean, literally everything from our bank accounts to our memories to our communications and to give somebody else carte blanche access to that just kind of really, to me, was giving them an awful lot of, it's not power, but a lot of access to our life.
Yes. And I actually would use the word power, right? Because dating violence, when you look at the definition of dating violence, it is a pattern of controlling and abusive behaviors that a person displays as a means to gain or maintain power in a relationship. So that is a power move on the part of the abuser to get access to that password, gives them the ability to be able to keep tabs. It gives them also the ability to install GPS tracking software onto their partner's phone. And so that to me is the number one reason to not for teens not to share their password or for them to not create a password that is a very simple password that someone could easily figure out. So in having that conversation, I think it's important to not only talk about like from a digital boundaries perspective, you know, don't share your password, but also make sure you have a password that isn't easy for someone to detect, like your birthday or a significant anniversary date or things like that, because that gives people the ability to quickly access that get that content on your phone. So I absolutely agree, and I'm so glad that you pointed that out.
Well, do you have, sorry, I just, do you have suggestions for how we can help our kids walk through that? That's a little bit of a minefield. I mean, they're new to relationships. They're figuring all this out. And this is a cultural norm. So What tools can we give them to essentially say no to that, but without turning themselves into a social pariah?
Right. So I believe that this conversation should be happening the moment that you give your child a phone or you purchase a phone for them, just to talk about digital boundaries with them and let them know like the potential consequences of sharing your password with people. Because when I go out and I do events, I have like an interactive activity booth where I ask teens questions. And one of the questions is, do you share your password with your partner? And they say, yes. And then I say, well, what did you know that your partner could do this, this, and this to your phone? And they are mortified. They're shocked. They're like, there's no way that they could do that. Not that they don't believe their partner could do it, but they just don't understand how that could actually happen. And so I think it's important for parents to show their teen exactly how their partner could do that. And I actually have guides and tutorials on that. If people sign up for my mailing list, you'll see that I send out quick tips for every type of social media that especially abusers use and how to set up your child's phone and help them set it up, because it should be a collaborative process. I don't believe that it should be just tell your child, do this, and then expect them to do it. It should be going through the process with them and sitting down and showing them, like, this is how quickly I can add this to your phone. This is what your partner could do with your phone, and just really having that dialogue about the potential things that could happen. Worst case scenarios is the way that I like to phrase it.
And we'll put in the show notes the actual link so that they can get and sign up to your email list, because I think that is a really valuable tool that they can use. And I am sitting here going, I can't even believe that this is something that our kids have to be worried about amidst all the other things about social media and digital world, that the challenges they're facing. And one question I had, especially about this digital part, we don't want to totally scare our kids about relationships and make the assumption that every single person is going to be putting tracking software on their phones, but they also need to be safe. So where do we walk that balancing line of giving them the information to keep them safe without making them feel like they can't trust another person?
Yes. And really, I think it's about talking to teens about setting expectations with their actual partner, right? Like them actually engaging in a dialogue with their partner when their partner proposes something to them, like, can I have your password? Or they want to look through their phones, like teaching teens how to have actual conversations with their partner and saying to the partner, you know, why is that important to you that you have my password? What are you concerned about? What are you worried about? And allowing them to have that dialogue with their partner is very important so that they can be able to get a sense of what their partner's intentions are. And that will help them be able to not necessarily be coming from a place of necessarily like fear, but more so of like, I'm trying to just set an expectation and a boundary with you. And if I'm noticing that you won't respect that boundary, you know, I get to make a decision at that point of whether or not I want to continue moving forward in this relationship, if I want to comply with this particular request. I also think it's important for when a teen encounters that, for them to be able to come to their parent or some trusted adult and be able to say, hey, I'm feeling a little pressure about doing this. But it is a tricky, you know, thing of trying to not be like danger, danger everywhere. And so the way I like to phrase it is I use what is called a stop, drop, and roll technique. And basically I say, you remember when you were younger and there was a fire, there was a idea of a potential fire. What did I used to tell you? I would tell you to stop, drop, and roll. We're going to use that same concept or that same framework. And we're going to say that in the event that you're in a relationship with somebody, and they are pressuring you to do something you don't want to do, or you feel unsafe in that relationship, these are the steps that you could take in order to keep yourself safe, in order to set a boundary with that particular person. So I like to not necessarily paint it as you need to be worry about, you know, your partner doing these things. It's more of like you're dating. I know you guys like to talk online and spend time together, but there might come a point where your partner asks you this. How do you feel about that? What will you do if your partner asks you to do this? I think you can keep the conversation somewhat light without making it like a fear tactic.
I love that. So before we get into the whole stop, drop, and roll technique, can we talk about the other types of abuse that are possible?
Yes. So the other type is physical violence, which is probably the main thing. When people hear the word dating violence, that's the first thing they think of, right? Someone hitting, punching, slapping, kicking their partner. And oftentimes, I think as a parent, that's not like something that you're thinking about, right? Like your kid's going out on a date, the last thing you're thinking about is that their partner is twisting their arm, or that they're biting them, or that they're shoving them, or choking them, or even burning them, which to me is just heartbreaking, because as a mental health counselor, this is the population that I work with. And I hear these experiences and these stories of teens telling me that their partner is doing these horrific things to them, and they feel like they can't tell anybody that this is happening to them. And at first I didn't think it was as prevalent. I mean, until I came across the data, which showed that it was 1.5 million high school students are experiencing physical abuse in a year. That's the average rate. And people don't know that it's happening because teens are concealing and hiding the bruises that they are actually experiencing from their partner. And it's just heartbreaking to hear that so many teens are not only experiencing bruises, but actual injuries and having to go to the ER because of the things that are happening to them in their relationships.
And you said the kids feel like they can't tell anyone about it.
Yes.
I'm wondering why they feel that way. And as parents, what can we do in our relationships with them to try and pave a path where they would?
Yes. So a lot of times teens in particular don't feel comfortable talking to their parents. So the data shows that 33% of teens that are in abusive relationships will tell anyone. And when they do tell someone, it's usually a friend. They feel more comfortable talking to their friends because they feel like they won't necessarily be judged and that that person can't really do anything, right? So when it comes to talking to parents, only 28% of those teens will tell their mom and 13% will tell their dad. And the reason that they don't tell them is because they know that their parents hold a certain level of power. Their parent is going to have a reaction to what is happening, and they're going to either cut off that relationship, you know, call law enforcement. They're going to do something right away, like an adult is going to take action. And so as parents, I really encourage, again, like having conversations before your child even starts to date, right? Like about the potential of what if your partner did do certain things like this? I want you to know that it's safe for you to come and talk to me, right? But a lot of times they don't do that because they're worried that their parent is going to have a very intense reaction. So the best thing that a parent can do is when your child shares something like that with you, or you might even notice like a bruise or things like that, when you're talking to your child, is to really be mindful of your own composure, your actual reaction to what they are saying to you. I mean, I know that's easier said than done because it's like, this is your child and they are in pain and in distress and you want to help them and fix the problem. But when someone is in an abusive relationship, they are essentially, you know, in the role of a victim. They feel very powerless. They've already had somebody that's been telling them what to do, how to do it. And so it has to feel collaborative of like, let's make a decision together. As opposed to, you must break up with this person right away. You need to leave them. We're calling law enforcement right away. It should be more of a conversation. Definitely, you know, as a parent, you at the end of the day make the executive decision of what to do to keep your child safe. But there does need to be a safety plan in place. So walking your child through safety planning before they break up with their partner is critical. And the reason for that is because when someone leaves a relationship, especially an abusive relationship, they are at increased risk of further harm. And it usually results in something, you know, much more violent, like an act of death. So I would really encourage parents to really express their concern that they're really worried about them, and that they're specifically worried about the things that's happening to their child, not so much about that guy or that girl is not good for you. They're horrible. You shouldn't let them treat you like that. It shouldn't feel that way. It should feel more like, I'm really worried about you and I'm really concerned about your well-being. And the things that you just told me are causing me to feel a little distressed and upset by what you just said. And I want you to be safe. And in order for you to be safe, there's some things that we need to do. How do you feel about us calling law enforcement, right? And if they're like, I don't want you to, I don't want them to get in trouble, you just validate that. I understand that. I do. And I get where you're coming from, but I need you to understand that, like, your well-being is of most concern to me, is most important to me. And so we are going to go ahead and call law enforcement, but I want this to be a decision we make together. And really just having that conversation until you can get that teen to the point where they feel comfortable with doing that.
Well, and you mentioned a safety plan. Mm-hmm. Can you kind of just give a general, what do you mean by that?
Yes. So safety plan usually has five components. And just very briefly, it's just generating a list of trusted adults or people who you can turn to whenever you find yourself in a situation where you don't feel safe. And that can be adults and it can also be friends. It also includes having a code word that you use with those individuals. So you would say to your team, you know, if you ever need me, text me. Are we having pizza for dinner or something like that? So that only you and your team knows what that word is. And that will send a distress signal to you that, like, they're in danger. They need help. And a lot of times I like to incorporate technology and use an app. It's called Circle of Six. And basically, if your team downloads that app, they can literally just push that button and it will send out a signal to your phone and whoever else they connected in that circle to let them know that I need you to pick me up. I need you to call law enforcement. And it will also give you their exact GPS location.
That's very, very powerful. And I don't want to take us off track, but I do just want to make a comment that, you know, as especially as we get into this discussion of physical abuse, so many people assume that it's always boys physically abusing girls or men physically abusing women. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that it's almost a 50-50 split on that, at least in the adult world. Is this the same as we're talking about teens and college students?
Yes, definitely. It's pretty equally proportioned. You will see that girls tend to perpetrate more lower forms of violence, like verbal and emotional and digital abuse, and guys tend to perpetrate physical and sexual violence. But the reason that data looks that way is because a lot of times when a male experiences physical or sexual violence, they're less likely to report that. So the data really isn't showing a true depiction of the prevalence rates, because it's a lot of underreporting happening on the end of the male. But I've had tons of male clients that have talked to me about the things that their partner does. And a lot of times their partner does things like burning them with their curling iron, and punching them and hitting them. But they don't perceive that as abuse. They don't see it that
way. And it's a cultural problem too. I've been more aware of that recently, is how it's okay for a girl to slap a man or punch a man, like that, or a woman to punch a man, or, you know, a girl to punch a boy, and somehow that's okay and that's acceptable. And it's not just because they are male and we are female, or even someone's bigger than us, does not make it okay. And I think that's something that it's a norm and a cultural idea that we can start changing and shaping, especially as, well, parents of daughters or sons, we can start changing that idea.
Yes, I agree. And I mean, one way to really challenge that, I found, is just looking at music videos with your teen, because it is very like female empowerment, right? Like, it's perceived as female empowerment if you kick this guy across the room, like in a Taylor Swift video or something like that, right? So they'll be like, yeah, she's so cool, she, you know, but using that to start a conversation and actually say, like, why is it okay for her to do that? But what if it was a guy that kicked her across the room, right? Really having those dialogues about, like, why is it acceptable for this particular gender to do that, but not another? Because accepting attitudes is really the biggest risk factor for someone being a perpetrator or a victim of dating violence. So I think the earlier that you have those conversations, the better.
I'm just so taken aback, because I have so many different thoughts in my head and concerns that I have about our kids now. And how do I know what to look for? It just seems like a lot of this stuff could happen behind the scenes, and it would be really hard as a parent to actually notice and understand. Do you have any tips for us what to look for that would be signs of abuse?
Yes. So I mentioned a couple of them, like the saying, I love you very quickly, is something to be concerned about, because usually after you say, I love you, like the rate of the relationship escalates pretty fast. And meaning that, like, things become more intimate much quicker whenever the word I love you is used very quickly. And I mean, like, in a matter of weeks, those words are being used. Another thing is really, like, more subtle. And that is, if you notice that your teen used to be very involved in a lot of things, and once they entered into a particular relationship, they no longer, not only are they not hanging out with their friends anymore, but they're not participating in extracurricular activities that they used to. You really want to inquire about that and ask them, like, you know, what's the reasoning for them no longer wanting to play lacrosse or basketball or whatever they're interested in, and really, really, you know, ask directly, like, does that have something to do with the relationship that you're in? Like, right, you're trying to spend more time with this person, but if you're in a healthy relationship, this person should support you. They should want you to participate in those activities, and they should show up at those things to cheer you on, right? So that's some more subtle ones. And then, of course, like I mentioned before, the excessive calling and texting is probably one of the huge, huge red flags, but specifically the time in which those calls are happening is really, really mostly concerning. But it's really about, you know, the way that the partner is acting towards your child, I think, is really to pay more attention to that. You know, like the mean and hurtful things that their partner is saying to them. A lot of times you wouldn't know that those things were happening if you didn't actually look at their text messages, if you didn't actually sit down and ask them, you know, like when you're in a relationship with your partner, has your partner ever said mean or hurtful things to you? Sometimes you have to directly ask those kind of questions. But for parents, a lot of times I just tell you to really look at changes in your child's physical and also their mental health. So you're noticing that your child is thinner, they're not eating, they're not sleeping, they're wearing oversized clothes, and it's the summertime, that could be concealing bruises. They're wearing a lot more makeup, maybe to conceal bruises, or because their partner, you know, is telling them that they want them to do that. Their attire has changed significantly because their partner wants them to wear something differently. These are things that, again, it's sometimes hard to distinguish, like, is this the result of dating violence, or is this just because they're a teenager and now they're starting to try to find other ways to express themselves? It's really about just noticing those actual changes and asking them, you know, what has led to those particular changes, and sometimes being really direct. But from a mental health standpoint, you really do want to pay attention to, like, your child's mood. You know, are they low? Are they isolated, standing in their room all the time, crying every time they get off the phone with their partner? They seem really anxious and on edge, almost hypervigilant about, you know, their partner showing up or being around them. They seem really uncomfortable around their partner, or very, very compliant. Like, they put their needs of their partner before their own. Like, I can't do that right now. I got to check with John to see if that'd be okay. That, to me, is a glaring red flag for parents to pay attention to.
So those are red flags to show what's happening. Are there things that we can do ahead of time to reduce our teen's risk of experiencing abuse in the first place?
Yes. So I really encourage parents to really sit down and have conversations with their teen before they start dating. I know I keep saying that, but I mean, from a prevention standpoint, that is the best thing that you can do, right? Like, and it's not that you couldn't still have these conversations once your child starts dating, but it's just better if you can get in front of that beforehand and really sit down and talk about these warning signs. Like, actually have a dialogue about, like, these are some things to take note of, right? But then I think it's also important to really assess if your teen is really ready to date. Right? Like, do they engage in help-seeking behaviors? Are they the type that when they find themselves in a situation, do they know to turn to somebody? Do they usually turn to somebody? If they don't, then that I would caution you about allowing your child to date, because when they find themselves in a situation, this is what teens tell me. I try to figure it out on my own first, and then when I can't handle it, I'll tell my parent. Right? That's what they often say is their strategy for dealing with issues in their world, in their dating relationships. And so you want to start out by talking to your teens as early as possible. And I'm not just saying teens. I'm talking about the moment that your child starts to consume content, media, where they see relationships on display, you should start having conversations with them. This will reduce their risk. So a perfect example is the cartoon Beauty and the Beast. That is a perfect example of someone who is in a relationship and a partner or character mistreats another person. And this person stays within this relationship and tolerates a lot of different things that they think are, like, you know, like, can be fixed about this person. And that kind of messaging gets into, you know, teens connect with that very early on as children. And so I really encourage having conversations early. And also safety planning before your child starts to date. Like, a safety plan in my world is usually implemented after something has happened, and then you're kind of reacting to the situation. But the safety plan should already be in place. So before you start to date, you would tell your child, in order for you to date, I would like us to have a plan in place in the event that something happens. That's my personal recommendation for reducing risk.
And I think just having that conversation, it's bringing an awareness. It's like talking about the different types of abuse, because I'm sure that our kids think the only kind of abuse is either physical or sexual. They don't think about all those other little things. So having that conversation, say, you know, these are the four types of abuse and the subtypes, you know, when you're talking about digital, these are the things that can happen. So let's have a plan, almost gives them the power and helps them know what to look for so that when they want to handle it themselves, they can get out before it becomes all-encompassing. And then they have this protective, they want to protect the perpetrator in some ways, you know, so those are great, great tips. I love it.
I'm also thinking that another helpful thing might be to ask our kids, well, why would someone stay, you know, to have, you know, and having this conversation going, here are different kinds of abuse and go, wow, you know, I mean, if a friend of yours was dating someone who actually did this to them, why would they stay in that relationship? What might stop them from leaving? Because I know that's one of the conversations that adults have. Oh, you know, this husband or this wife or this spouse was in an abusive relationship. Well, why don't they leave? They should just leave. And there are reasons that people don't leave. And so I think exploring that with our kids, again, correct me if I'm wrong, Shalonda, but that would be a way of finding out what their thoughts are about the situation and help to straighten out any thinking, or even just help them recognize and create healthier boundaries. Like one of the reasons would stay for people to stay is, oh, they'll change. I can help them. If I love them enough, they'll change. And maybe we can help them see that thinking doesn't play out in the real world.
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's so, so important. And a lot of times teens don't want to talk to you about their relationships, right? They're like, oh, mom, dad, this is awkward. I don't want to talk to you about this. But they're quick to tell you about other people, right? What their friends are doing, what they think about what other people are doing or why they're not doing certain things. They have lots of opinions about other people. And so I definitely agree to, you know, ask their perspective about other people's actions, right? And then that can lead into a conversation about now if you found yourself in that situation, like how would you respond? What might be your deal breaker in your relationship? What's too far for you to where you would say, this is unacceptable and I will not tolerate this in my relationship?
Yeah, interesting. Okay, so I just want to... I'm just going to hit a few really high points. We're going to have so much of this in the show notes on mightyparenting.com. So you can go there, mightyparenting.com/podcast, and you can go to Dr. Moten's episode. But there are different types of dating violence or dating abuse. There's emotional, digital, physical, and sexual. And the emotional abuse can involve yelling, screaming, saying mean things, threatening themselves or others, you know, if you leave me, I will hurt myself type of a thing. It can be facial expressions, smashing things against the wall, as kids would describe it as mind games. And one thing definitely that goes in there is isolation. A red flag there is when at the beginning of a relationship, when things move quickly and then people kind of naturally draw back to their life, if a partner is having issues with that or reacting badly to that, that's a red flag. In the digital world, not only is there digital or technology abuse, there are four different kinds of that. There's textual harassment, where people are texting all hours of the day and night. Sexting harassment, where they're asking you to send images or videos that are sexually explicit and then using them to blackmail. There's digital stalking, where you're keeping tabs on the partner, on everything they do, following their friends, looking into everything they're doing online, or the cyberbullying by proxy, which actually draws friends in to do the same thing. They enlist their friends to cyberstalk and tell them, you know, if he does something inappropriate or she does something wrong, make mean comments and try to control them that way. We need to teach our kids about digital boundaries and the risks of sharing passwords. And we'll add the link for Dr. Moten's email series in there so you can get the information on how to teach your kids that. We need to have our kids learn how to have conversations with a partner and set expectations. When that person asks for the password to their phone, have them have a conversation asking why that's important to their partner, what they're concerned about, what they're worried about, and learn to set boundaries there. And if this person they're dating won't accept those boundaries, then we need to teach our kids that that's something they need to think about. Is this the type of person you want to be in a relationship with, and what's going on there? In physical violence, there are things going on that we would not normally think of. Common types of physical violence include twisting someone's arm, biting them, choking them, burning them, and our teens just feel like they can't tell anyone. Only 33% will tell someone, and usually that's a friend, because they feel they won't be judged and the friend doesn't have power. They don't want to tell their parents because their parents will do something. And really interesting piece there that caught my attention, Shalonda, was you said that they've already been a victim. And as parents, when we jump in and take over, we're just piling on with that. And we need to have conversation and make decisions together. Keep them safe still, but to work through that together. And we all need to talk to our kids about safety plans. And we need to start having open dialogue with them. We need to prepare them for the dating world, make sure they're ready for the dating world. And a few things that we can do is have a conversation before they're dating, make sure they understand some of these warning signs, have some of those what would you do if conversations, and make sure they have a safety plan. And use the media, use all the stuff that's out there to start conversations about things, like you said, about Beauty and the Beast or the videos, and keep an eye out for those red flags ourselves. I love you early in a relationship, withdrawing from friends or activities, ask them why that's happening, excessive calling and texting from a partner, noticing how the partner acts towards our child, changes in our child's physical appearance or their physical or mental health. So Shalonda, there's obviously a lot here. And as I said, we'll put that email link in, but could you just share your website for our parents who would like to get more information?
Yes, you can go to preventioncollective.co, or you can go to my direct website, which is drmoten.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Moten. It is just been eye-opening, to say the least, and this is such an important topic. As we said at the top of the hour, it is something that, while it's a tough topic and we only scratched the surface today, it is something that we as families need to be discussing with our kids, ideally before they begin dating, but for sure while they're in the dating process, and just open our kids' eyes and know that we're walking alongside them. And if they run into a challenge, we're going to be there to walk them and guide them through it. So thank you so much for being with us today. And our listeners, remember, you are a mighty parent. And this is Judy Davis and Sandy Fowler looking forward to having you with us next week.